Pro Savings Days are on at Lowe's. Get up to 35% off select major appliances. Plus, My Lowe's Pro Rewards members get an additional 5% off when you buy 5 or more select GE, Whirlpool, and Electrolux kitchen or laundry major appliances. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 123. Discount valid to My Lowe's Pro Rewards members only. Exclusions and other restrictions apply. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See associate or Lowe's.com for details. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Visit Lowe's.com/terms for details. Subject to change.
Remember how you came to be here, putting into this foul harbour where the dead cats bob upon the grey cap waves amongst the oil drums and the excrement. You don't recall who booked your passage, stamped your passport, led you here to this dark country that's both hideously unfamiliar, hideously recognisable, just like a crash survivor's first glimpse of her new reflected face. You lick away the salt the fog has left there at the corners of your mouth. You grip the rail and hear the drunken, roaring ocean slap the ship around, two downstairs neighbours in a bedroom fight. You watch the coastline crawling nearer, and although you've seen that picture postcard view 1,000 times before, it's all so different somehow. Where are those serene, hand-tinted skies of perfect blue? Who took away those sun-bronzed towers and left a smoked necropolis? These buildings, this benighted landscape, this is not your home. It is instead as if someone had traced the shadow of America, has taken an impression and from that impression cast in concrete a vast continent of shadows, ruled by flashlight phantoms, spooks and silhouettes. The foghorn mourns. The black wharfs are approaching. This is not a dream.
Welcome back to Midlight Grappler Animals, the home of Flub Nation. I literally just flubbed right there. I'm not going to fix that. Salt's not going to fix that. It's been a while. You know, it's funny because last week I went to my convocation, the one that I should have had 2 years ago, but then because of COVID never ended up happening. And my go-to whenever I saw people that I hadn't talked to in those 2 years was, it's been a while.
It's been a while.
It's been a while. It's very versatile.
What con was that?
Huh?
You said you were at a con?
Oh, a convocation, you know, like graduation from university.
Oh.
Yeah. It was...
Congratulations.
I don't know if it's a warrant. I don't know if it warrants congratulations. It was nice seeing people. But at the end of the day, I was literally just there to walk across the stage. Not even like get a handshake. I got no handshakes. Not even a single piece of paper. The paper that I was supposed to get was sitting in my closet all the way back home while I was walking across that stage.
It's dark.
So, you know, always a good way to close out your university career. Salt, it's been a while.
Been a while. And it's been a while for our dear readers. You might have guessed, based on the description of this episode, that we would be discussing the Alan Moore, Bill Sienkiewicz collaboration brought to light. But, you know, Land and I got to talking, and there are some other Alan Moore works I think we could go over instead.
Yeah.
And when I'm saying Alan Moore, I guess I'm more saying the adjacent extended Alan
Moore. I see what you did there.
There's a greater world of Moore I want to explore. And so I was thinking, you know what? It's time for a greater cultural reappropriation of Jeff Johns's seminal work, Doomsday Clock.
Absolutely fantastic. It's truly, Yeah, unrivaled, I would say. You know,
underrated even.
Underrated, definitely. Undisposed. You got any other words to start with? Undefeated.
Understands. How about this? Understands Watchmen greater than Alan Moore himself.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Because Watchmen, great book, but you set it down and you leave with more questions than answers. And I needed some
more
answers.
Questions. Ah, you did it again.
See what I did?
Okay.
It's a bit of a Rorschach test, right? Right?
Yeah. Oh, okay. Oh, some real jokers this episode.
A comedian, if you will.
Fuck me, I walked right into that one. It's fantastic that we're doing this episode on such an uncontroversial team, such as Alan Moore and Bill Sienkiewicz, two of the most uncontroversial men in the comics industry, I'd say.
Well, I just need to let people know now, this is a pro-Sienkiewicz podcast.
Yes, pro. Are we more agnostic?
I'm pro, Lan. I'm pro Sienkiewicz.
Oh, you're pro? Okay.
He's my boy.
You're pro Sienkiewicz. Okay, but what about Moore? Again, if we're doing an artist v. writers thing, I guess I'm going to have to take this out of Moore.
Yeah, I mean, you're only allowed one.
Forced my hand. Yeah, you forced my hand, so I guess I'm pro Moore this time.
Yeah, that's okay.
You know, it's funny. I actually did an entire video about Alan Moore versus DC back when I was doing the whole YouTube thing. I think it's like my most viewed video on the channel. Yeah, it's.
Did you pick Alan Moore or DC?
Oh shit, that one. Yeah, I agnostic for sure. Agnostic for sure. No, I'm kidding. Yeah, it was definitely much more positive towards Moore, unsurprisingly. But it definitely opened my eyes to just the degree of how much he got fucked over. Because everyone knows he got fucked over, yeah. Like, DC fucked him over, yeah. But the degree to which is really just scraping the iceberg, if you know.
I have a question about that for you, actually.
Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, he loves to cite, you know, how Siegel, Schuster, Finger, how they all got, like, you know, rat fucked by the higher ups at DC. Did he know about that prior to signing his Watchmen contract?
I think he did, but at the
he's like, oh, they changed.
Yeah, I think it was more so like, because if I remember correctly, he signed the Watchmen contract after Adams had gotten Neil Adams. Had fought and won the whole thing with Siegel and Schuster getting their rights. So I think he might have just had the naivete to think that the winds of change were blowing and sort of that, on top of the fact that he also didn't think that the book would sell long enough to, you know, not break the copyright.
Right. I think that's probably the most important detail.
Yeah, I mean, again, just sheer naivete on Moore's part, which, you know, some people can fault him for, some people can't. And, you know, I guess
since I am, print before that, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it was the 80s, you know, like what the fuck was actually staying in print?
Right. That was like totally unprecedented.
But we're not here to talk about Watchmen. We're here to talk about some other men who watch.
Men?
See what I'm getting at there? And actually, they don't just watch. They do. They infiltrate. They subjugate. They install puppet leaders, if you will. These men in black. See what I'm getting? You see where I'm going here?
I really like it. Yeah, I want to see how long you write it out.
These suits, even.
Company men, if you will.
Company men? You know, Morrison had the U-Men in his X-Men run. How about the G-Men?
Okay.
New superheroes hitting the block. The G-Men.
In their secret base in Langley, Virginia.
In Langley, Virginia. Today, our heroes shall face the opium crisis.
maybe even accelerated. Yeah. So we are talking Brought to Light. So Brought to Light was published a year after Watchmen concluded. And I think that's pretty key, right? For thinking about like what mindset Moore was in.
Yeah, it was a very interesting time because I think it was 88 that Moore actually, you know, fully cut ties with DC over the age rating thing. So this was like in that really weird middle space between, like, it was right sandwiched between those two seminal moments in Moore's career. And it's also just a book that I guess doesn't get brought up very often at all, both when talking about Moore's career and Sienkiewicz's careers. Yeah, do you want to give us the rundown of what exactly Brought to Light is, Salt?
For sure, yeah. Thanks, Lan. I'm glad that you mentioned this doesn't get brought up a lot, because I think it's a really fascinating book, and that's why we're doing it. Yeah, there's sort of four players I want to cover. We'll spend the bulk of our time covering before we do an overall analysis of the book and reflection on it. We'll be talking about Moore, which we've gotten into a bit. And despite the title of this episode, I have a lot I want to say about our other players as well. There's Sienkiewicz, his collaborator. And then I think two other really key players in understanding Brought to Light is the publisher, Eclipse Comics. And I don't know their exact role, if they're co-publisher or financier. They definitely finance the book, but the Christic Institute. What would you call, like, a law group, advocacy group?
I would call them a nonprofit organization, but that was that title was stripped from them. So I think the best way we can refer to them is as a law firm, which was founded by Daniel Sheehan in 1980 with his wife, Sarah Nelson, as well as their partner, William Davis. The Christic Institute in and of itself is like a very interesting party in all of this. I think just mainly insofar as what the hell they're doing with comics in the first place.
This Brought to Light has two stories it tells. The first story is by Moore and Sienkiewicz. And that story, The Shadow Team, is just
Shadow Play, the secret team.
Thank you. That story is broadly recapping the history of covert operations by the CIA, primarily foreign ones, as their entire agenda ostensibly is supposed to be. But it's just covering like the sort of origins of the CIA up until the present day at the time, the publishing. So it gets into the late 80s. A lot of the research comes from the Christic Institute itself. The book itself, the story itself is wonderful. It does a lot, but it's also kind of a recap in what it's doing. So we're not going to try to do too much recapping of the story, as that's largely
we're not recapping a recap.
Right, thank you.
Yeah, no, we're not doing some Morrison shit here. We're not recapping a recap of a recap.
Yeah, the only other thing I want to say about this book itself, before we get back to the Christic Institute, is the second story. I don't have the creators' names at hand.
It's Joyce Brabner and, who did the art on that one? Tom Yeats. Or Yeats. Yeah, I'm just going to say Yeats. Tom Yeats.
That story largely tells the history of the Lapenka bombing, which was a pretty big case that the Christic Institute took upon itself to try to sue the CIA and the United States for. That case didn't go so well for them. So anyways, this is a lot to unwrap. I've got a lot of research myself on the Christic Institute I want to go over, but I want to turn it back to you about what you were saying about the origins of the Christic Institute and what they do, because they're really interesting.
Right. So the first big case that the Christic Institute took on was the Silkwood case. This is like apparently a very famous case. Again, I never heard of it until we were doing research for this episode, but basically a factory worker and a chemical technician, I should say, at a nuclear pellet making site. She was making plutonium pellets.
Karen McGee.
Yes, Karen.
Karen McGee. And Karen McGee is the name of the nuclear
the site. Company. Yes, Karen McGee is the company, the corporation. So yeah, she pretty much was found to have an extreme amount of plutonium contamination on her, and she pretty much died and was the central figure in the case that the Christic Institute formed, which formed the case Silkwood versus Karen McGee. And that was a huge case that they ended up winning. The company ended up settling out of court. And the story itself was actually picked up and turned into a movie by Mike Nichols. And it was the movie was apparently significant enough to win or to get a nomination at the Oscars. So it is a pretty big sort of launch point for this institute. From there onwards, they would also take other cases. Again, the Three Mile Island case, which is pretty much another nuclear case. And they also prosecuted the Greensboro Massacre, which was a case where KKK and Nazi Party members had killed communist workers. There is quite a lot of history there. So as much as I could do research into the Institute, there was never really anything I could find about how they got in touch with Eclipse or like Moore Sienkiewicz. Like
I did a fair amount of research into Eclipse itself, and there's a certain figure at Eclipse I want to talk about. And everything I'll say is sort of like rumination on my part, sort of guessing. And it kind of can explain how I think they got together.
Okay. Because everything surrounding like the inception of this comic kind of just feels like it came out of the ether, you know, like these are all separate bodies, separate parties that, you know, like were doing their own thing, you know, like the Christic Institute was pretty much taking on like these big cases that also had nothing really to do at the time, I should say, had nothing to do with CIA and their whole operations until we get to another big case they do, Avergan versus Hull, which we will discuss later on, which, you know, now that I'm thinking about it, might actually be the link between them. But Salt, I want to hear your sort of theory as to Eclipse and their role in this.
Eclipse, do you know much about them, Lan?
Yeah, I've, you know, like seen their name pop up multiple times, you know, like when I was reading comics. As for like what of their stuff I've actually read,
Rocketeer is like the big one to me.
Yeah, Rocketeer. They also partnered with Viz Media in their very, very early stages to publish manga. So like stuff like The Legend of Kamui was a joint publication between Viz and Eclipse.
Yeah, what's really fascinating about Eclipse is there's a lot of firsts in their publishing history. You know, they're doing like some of the first graphic novels to go to the direct market. They're one of the first people to publish manga. They're also like paying creators like a lot better, according to the sources I read. And like I knew they were big. I had a lot of Eclipse comics at one point. I did not realize that they were like in the same league as Marvel and DC. Like towards the late 80s, they were selling like 500,000 books per month, which is insane to imagine.
Also, I kind of wanted to lead in with the sort of baseline stuff before dropping the big bomb, which is that this Eclipse is the company
also
that
does not exist.
Miracle Man. Oh yeah, they don't exist anymore. But they're also the former publisher of Miracle Man, now known as Marvel Man. Or actually, it's the other way around. It used to be Marvel Man, now known as Miracle Man. So again, we clearly have that sort of connection between them and Moore already there. Another fun fact I can pull out of my ass is it's like one of the earliest publications that Chuck Austin worked for.
Yes.
That's pretty rad. Because he did some issues of Miracle Man. You know, it's funny. I actually recorded an interview with Chuck Austin with the intent of actually publishing it as like a written interview series, which was back when I was actually writing comic script. But, you know, that clearly fell through because the place where I was actually trying to publish it ceased existing. But in that interview, I actually do actually talk to him about what it was like working with Alan Moore at Eclipse on Miracle Man. It was a really enlightening conversation, but I don't know. We'll see if I can find some way to actually publish that sometime.
Eclipse is breaking new ground in lots of ways in the 80s. There is a figure at Eclipse I want to talk about. Have you heard of a figure? Catherine Ironwood?
No.
I had never heard
listeners. Dude. Okay.
I had never heard of this.
Drop the bomb on me.
Here's the bomb. Yeah, I had never heard of Catherine Ironwood before this book, despite I'd read a lot of Eclipse. She is credited in the actual Brought to Light book as the vice president and editor-in-chief of Eclipse. She's also credited as the executive editor. So I am sort of postulating that she had some connection to the Christic Institute, that she followed their work.
Okay.
I'm just going to say this is maybe one of the most interesting people to ever live. I got all this from scanning her Wikipedia. I haven't even done like a deep dive. So she's born in San Francisco, and her mom is actually an Ashkenazi Jewish refugee from Nazi Germany.
Okay.
So, like, you can kind of understand where a left-leaning outlook might come from.
Right, okay.
Now, the mom, one of the parents is involved in the book business, I believe. I think that's how Ironwood gets into selling books. So she gets into the book-selling business, the newspaper publishing business. You can see how that kind of leads to comics. She's got a publication called the San Francisco Express Times for a second. And, you know, that's interesting to me because I live here in San Francisco. And so I'd never heard of this before, but it's the comics and trading cards that is most fascinating. At one point, Ironwood writes this index for the Doctor Strange books. And I'm not sure what that is, but it's called the Lesser Book of Vishanti. But this small press book is like so key to the Doctor Strange fans that like apparently the writers themselves are consulting it. So I guess it's like collecting the spells or something.
It's weird that she had that because I'm looking into it now and they're saying that Marvel writers are said to have consulted this book. So it definitely and now I'm noticing that she is a practitioner of folk magic. So that probably explains the Moore connection. Wow, God. Okay, keep going, because
I told insane. You, very interesting person. At one point, she is writing and working with Will Eisner. She's doing a book to promote his art, and I think she's even archiving his work at a certain point. So she's you know already connected to one of the greatest artists in the medium. And through her work with, damn it, dog, it's like traipsing over my headset. There's your Flub Nation. While she's working for Eisner, she goes to this comics party and she meets Dean Mullaney, the other co-founder of Eclipse, and they run this publisher together. You know, the rest is sort of history. We're already going over Eclipse's bona fides. This, I think, is one of the most fascinating parts of her history. She, at one point, via Ironwood, Eclipse starts selling non-sports trading cards. So there's trading card sets from Eclipse for Iran-Contra, the savings and loan crisis, the AIDS epidemic, the Kennedy assassination.
I'm going to find this because this is...
Well, and Eclipse. You know, it kind of like set off a little, like, I don't know, light or something in my head because I recently watched one of the old Addams Family movies recently. And... the woman that Fester is dating in that is like on one of the trading cards or one of the characters is collecting serial killer trading cards. And I can't prove it, but I would bet those trading cards are referencing the Eclipse Comics trading cards.
Huh.
I just think that's relevant because, like, clearly these cards were, like, interesting to people. People were buying them.
Yeah, I'm actually looking at some of these, and these are really insane. Like, yeah, I'm looking at the cards. It's like, they're not necessarily caricatures, but there's one that's captioned the Medellin Cartel. And and it's like a snowy mountains. And if you can already tell what the snow here is. And it's two dudes shoveling this snow into the nostrils of Uncle Sam, who is just like a huge head in the middle of the snow. Oh, I need rocks to save this because this is insane. And they were publishing this shit.
Yeah, I mean, the ones that I really fucking want, dude, like, I'm probably gonna buy a set someday, are the JFK trading cards, and these look like they're done by Sienkiewicz. Like, these, like, fucking rule. Yeah, these are rad. There's, like, I think we got to bring trading cards back.
Yeah, trading cards back is not NFT bullshit, though.
Not NFC.
You know, I was so excited for trading cards to, like, make a big comeback, and then they came back and they were like, "Oh, your trading cards are NFTs now.
Digital trading cards. $5 million
for these digital trading cards, and suck my dick." Yeah, we need more CIA trading cards. Yeah. You know, like, update that
anti-CIA.
Anti-CIA, I should say. Yeah. We should get Oliver Stone to you know, like, promote, yes, these trading cards. When was the last time Oliver Stone put out a movie?
He just did a new JFK documentary. It's called JFK Another Revisited. One?
Oh, okay.
Well, so the 91 is a drama. The movie.
Yeah.
But this one that came out recently is a documentary looking at the evidence that has come out in, you know, the decades since. And there's two versions of it. There's, like, I think a 2-hour version and a 4-hour version. And the 4-hour version is split into hour long parts. The 2-hour version is pretty good, but I actually thought the 4-hour version was superior.
Interesting.
And it's a little bit for the nerds. I mean, you know, I think the JFK movie he did in 91 is just, it's a good movie on its own.
Right.
But, yeah, like, you know, if you've read some books or you want to get into the weeds of it a little bit more. Yeah. I think it's a good film.
Yeah. I mean, the main reason I bring up Oliver Stone at all is, like, I think with Brought to Light, I think the big sort of initial pushback that I think any sort of layman reader would give is, like, this reads like the comics equivalent of an Oliver Stone movie.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, that's definitely something I want to really get into by the end of the episode. But I think, you know, one thing to bear in mind for this book is that a lot of it's dealing with, I would say the two topics Brought to Light covers most is the sort of golden triangle, the heroin trafficking out of Southeast Asia, and Iran-Contra. And I mean, those, like, everything is reported. Like, you can find all of it, like, on, like, reputable websites.
Like, I'm reading this, and I'm a small part of my brain is like, oh my god, this is scandalous. Why isn't anyone talking about this? But then this is all, like, reported fact.
But you're right. No one is talking about it. Like, all these people, like, no one was prosecuted. Oliver North went on to become head of the NRA and got a cameo role in the newest Call of Duty. there was a scandal, and yet there was no scandal. There was no fallout from the scandal. Anyways, I could go on and on and on about all that, but I'm really just trying to talk about the phenomenon of the book itself. And
right,
you feel free to curb me if I'm going down one of those.
Oh no, I'm still trying to recover from the trading cards.
Oh, they're so fucking metal, man. They rule.
God damn. But yeah, what do you want to get into first with this?
I mean, we covered most of Eclipse and kind of touched on Christic. Are you all right if we go into Sienkiewicz a little bit?
Yeah, sure. My good man Sienkiewicz, the one of the few old head comics artists that haven't blocked me yet.
Hey, Sienkiewicz can do no wrong.
Sienkiewicz can absolutely do no wrong. Sienkiewicz, famously known for his portraits of dead celebrities hours after their death, used to do comics, actually, believe it or not.
it's not easy to pay those bills, all right?
Do you think anyone's actually paid for the... sorry to derail this. Do you think anyone's actually paid for one of those, posthumous portraits?
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah, like those are for people who would never read comics, you know.
Cuz I saw he posted one, I think it was either today or yesterday, of the fucking the puma that got killed in Hollywood.
Yeah.
I didn't even know about this thing. These are your ends, so you got to inform me about when this stuff happens, but he's now doing portraits of dead animals. Sienkiewicz used to be a comic artist.
Yeah, damn good one. I was doing a lot of Sienkiewicz research on this because I've read a ton of his books. I've always loved the man's art, but I was trying to figure out where he stood politically. And I think that's relevant to this book because, sort of what I want to be our main thesis, as it were, the main question of this episode, at least we can answer or contemplate on by the end, is like, you know, how does a book like this get published? And, you know, more importantly, like, why are we not seeing books like this still? And, you know, we're talking about really complex circumstances and the creators involved. So Sienkiewicz himself has to have some level of interest in this, right?
Yeah, and that's what I mean. Like, it does feel like it, like I said before, it feels like this book kind of just came out of the ether. And Sienkiewicz's involvement, like, more, you're like, oh yeah, sure, I can see more doing this. Ironwood, yeah, okay, sure. And I've read up about her now, so, you know, like, I can see her doing this. But Sienkiewicz is like the odd one out, in a sense.
He is the odd one, man, because, you know, the best research I can do for Sienkiewicz is like a lot of these sort of like discrepancies, and it's gonna sound kind of listicle-ish, but like, I think it's really key for understanding Sienkiewicz the man. In an interview with him, I found he's saying, like, oh, you know, on a scale of, like, 1 to 10, like, 1 being Republican and 10 being liberal, like, I'm an 11. Like, I'm almost a communist. Like, that's... I really dig how Sienkiewicz is, like, one of those Twitter... No, guys, you don't understand. I'm, like, a real communist. But, you know, like, that's cool. Like, he just explicitly says, like, I think everyone should have healthcare. And, like, I don't know a lot of comics creators who are that explicit about that. Like, it's good to hear.
I mean, you also don't see many comics creator explicit about the fact that they got cucked in the 80s. So, in a way, Sienkiewicz is a real trailblazer in many, many facets.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to say about Sienkiewicz here that is not going to sound flattering, but, like, I fucking love, like, this guy.
Everything I say in this episode about Sienkiewicz comes from a place of peace and love. You know, like, I'm not going to make fun of him for the fact that his wife cheated on him with Tony Sammons in the 80s. That's a horrible thing to do.
That would be wrong.
I would never do that. Yeah. It's a horrible thing to do. I would never do that. but I feel like it, and I'm definitely not going to use that to cast aspersions on his politics, because his politics, I think, for the most part, are pretty good, right?
Yeah, I think his politics are pretty good. And I think where this is relevant to is, again, in the same interview, I saw Bill saying how, like, he actually used to go to Christic Institute lectures.
Oh, interesting.
And so, like, he was involved in that sense, and that was, he was reasonably certain he was being, like, monitored while he was making Brought to Light, getting, like, weird phone calls. Like,
I mean, he did eventually encounter the Secret Service later on in his,
yes,
life.
I've been just gabbing nonstop. Do you mind reading this from Comic Book Resources, because this is fucking,
sure,
incredible.
This, so so this is back when CBR, Comic Book Resources, for the uninitiated, used to actually publish articles.
Yeah, it was a good time.
So they used to have this column called Comic Book Legends, where they would sort of go over these legends or these sort of myths, per se, in comics, in the comics industry, comics community, pretty much just going over whether or not they were real. And one time they covered Billy, I'm calling him Billy Goodpaul, when he was encountered, when he encountered the Secret Service, because of a post he made about Trump. So this happened in 2017. So, you know, obviously in the height of Trump's presidency, you know, it was a great time for left-leaning or sort of even liberal comics creators to sort of, you know, be vocal about Trump and his whole thing. Our good friend Bill decides not to really tack, it's not even for his politics per se, but his hands, and not even the size or whatever, specifically his handshakes. He posted on his Facebook, the great thing about Sienkiewicz is his Facebook is the cleanest line of direct contact with him. Just for readers at home who want that parasocial relationship with Bill Sienkiewicz. And he posted about Trump's handshakes, because Trump had a tendency to grab the other person's hand, but also grab with both hands. So it's kind of like he's yoinking and pulling them towards him. Bill, after making fun of that, offered a sketch to anyone who would turn the tables on Trump, saying, you know, like, if you can do the pullback on him, an epic pwn, an absolutely epic pwn on Trump to yank him off balance before he gets to yank them on balance, off balance. And then he drew a bunch of pictures titled The Most Punchable Faces of 2017.
I didn't want to gloss over the fact that you would get a free sketch from Bill. So yes, if you wanted a portrait of Christopher Reeve or whatever.
Whatever celebrity Trump died over in 2017, you know, like just hours
right.
He would give it to you. So then he went and did some other sketches, not of people who had died, but people who were still alive in the Trump administration. And he titled this series The Most Punchable Faces of 2017. Truly fantastic posting. He actually posted a follow-up later on his Facebook, again, talking about his experience with the Secret Service, where he was woken up by the Secret Service and questioned for about an hour and a half about the post he made about offering the sketch to anyone who would shake Trump's hand. And luckily he got off scot-free, you know, like they seem to have, you know, not seen him as a threat to the government of the United States of America. And it was, the funny thing is how it ended, because afterwards he was like, oh, you know, I was thankful because it was proof that they were doing their jobs. It was proof that
the system works.
I'm like, Bill, come on, man.
Hey, he's an 11, all right?
Yeah. He's an 11. No, he's an 11. Not a 12, guys. Oh, I should say this is also in response to the January 6th. All it took was an insurrection for Bill to reveal that he was visited by Secret Service agents in 2017.
Very good and cool Secret Service agents that he showed his gratitude toward.
Yeah.
And his ass, his actual literal ass. You know, I really thought all this stuff was relevant. What is not relevant, but I find really interesting, is in my research of Sienkiewicz at the 25th anniversary for Marvel at the 86 San Diego Comic Con. Shooter found a way, Jim Shooter,
classic guy,
found a way to like bring Sienkiewicz along on the trip if Sienkiewicz would agree to be Spider-Man. And this is according to Shooter, who like honestly seems more full of shit to me, like five times more full of shit to me than Stan Lee.
Absolutely. And again, scale wise, if Bill is an 11, I feel like Shooter is like a 0. Or a -1 even.
Yeah.
so two like This is an unstoppable force meets an immovable object.
Shooter gets Bill to dress up as Spider-Man. They like bring him to the con. For whatever reason, they go to like
SeaWorld
later. And according to Shooter, like it's like this, you know, sort of Morrisonian moment, you know, when you think of Morrison, like meeting Superman at the lunch table, like apparently like Sienkiewicz puts on this Spider-Man suit and starts like quipping and jumping around. And he says like, oh yeah, like Bill did a backflip off of like one of the highest tables or one of the highest benches, like onto the ground. And there was a mob around us. And, you know, I just want to put a little like editorial opinion in there as someone who like does backflips professionally. You can like fall face forward, but in a like an athletic way, and people will say you did a backflip. So, I don't know if Sienkiewicz was really doing backflips in the Spider-Man suit. I think my two favorite takeaways from this is a crowd like gathers around them, and apparently there are hundreds of people wearing Spider-Man shirts. They're all demanding a picture with Bill until Shooter says, "Fuck off."
Disperses the crowd.
So he gets Bill
to do all this shit, and then when people actually react to it, he's like, fuck off.
Yeah, this story doesn't make any sense. I think the other really great detail is apparently like the cops saw them at one point and thought they were the coolest guys. So like the cops like asked Bill in his Spider-Man suit to like sit on these San Diego PD motorcycle. If any of this is true, and I can find this picture of Bill Sienkiewicz on a motorcycle,
listen, I'm trying to find this picture right now, and I can't. I feel like, listen,
it doesn't exist.
If Jim Shooter wasn't full of shit, he would have posted a picture.
I know.
You don't say you dressed up Bill Sienkiewicz as Spider-Man and got him to do a bunch of fucking backflips without taking a single picture.
I know. It's a great story, but it didn't happen.
Needless to say, odd one out. Bill Sienkiewicz, yeah. The odd one out.
One more Sienkiewicz detail, I promise, is like in my research of him, I found out he was like recently drawing like portraits or like respectful caricatures of RBG. So like, I just want to say, I think his politics, if I had to really sum it up, is like he's what I would call an epic lib. You know, knock Trump off balance and you'll get a sketchbook. Like, I don't want a freaking Cheeto in the White House. Healthcare for all. Like, you know, like, it's kind of cringy, but like I get where he's coming from. Yeah,
it's like he's got good intentions, but it also makes me wonder how much his politics have shifted since he did brought to light. Because I feel bill that did brought to light is far more radical than the bill that did that portrait of the fucking Puma.
Oh, I would completely agree because, like, you know, in the interviews I watched with him, you know, he's like he's talking about his politics and, you know, the experience of working brought to light. And he has to preface it at least once by going like, oh, hey, you know, I've got these beliefs about like what's really going on. But like, I'm not an Alex Jones type. Right. And I think that was really key. And it's like it's a thing that I think both it agrees with what you're saying, that they're not the same bills. But I also think it really succinctly sums up like how the world has changed. And it's kind of one of the greater points I want to come back that I've been trying to make this episode about, like why you can't do this book anymore, because we're looking at like real crimes by the CIA. A lot of these crimes are like easily sourceable and undeniable. But when you try to talk about this stuff, you know, it either sounds like Alex Jones cuckoo stuff to people, or like people are afraid, and sometimes rightly so, of sounding like, you know, some hateful far right crackpot.
Yeah. I mean, like in Oliver Stone's case, right? Like, he teeters on that line of sort of conspiracy theory, like right-wing-esque conspiracy theory, even though he is a self-proclaimed leftist. And yeah, I think that's definitely the tough thing about this, and also the Christic Institute in general is, like, they start off very left-leaning But you know, like over the course of sort of delving into the conspiracy elements or sort of the underground, not so much known to the layperson element of the CIA and whatnot, there is that sort of fear of them, you know, repeating beats from right-wing conspiracy theories and whatnot. It's a tough line to walk.
So I saw that accusation that they, you know, were repeating right-wing talking points, but I couldn't find anything substantial there. Could you?
No, I feel like it pretty much just goes under the vein of, you know, like right-wing anti-government rhetoric lining up with sort of the, you know, conspiracy theory elites, lizard people bullshit. Whenever they see, again, Stone or the Christic Institute or whatever talk about these sort of misdeeds that the government did, it sort of, you know, sort of replicates that, you know, like the shadow government, I think, is the big element to look at here. I think there was actually a Christic Institute poster that was like investigate the shadow government or unmask the shadow government. There we go. But that's not the Christic Institute, that's the Romero Institute, which is the offspring of the Christic Institute. But yeah, the whole thing with the shadow government, I can definitely see why people would be sort of antsy, I just to put it nicely, about the politics of these things.
Well, and I've seen the criticism too that like a lot of what is called conspiracy theory can fit really well in a sort of libertarian orbit because you can look at how fundamentally broken and corrupt a lot of the system is, and then your conclusion can be, oh, well, we just shouldn't have a government, shouldn't try to get involved with the government. Less government is better. And, you know, to that I say, like, you know, even if someone is believing in those theories, like that doesn't need to be the conclusion you come to. I mean, I think what Brought to Light does really well in its, you know, sort of CIA 101 is it shows that for Americans, like your government is not your government. Like you actually deserve to have a real government, but yeah. Like the government you have is created from the ashes of the Nazi phoenix. I mean, a lot of the research I did in this episode came from Michael S. Judge of Death is Just Around the Corner, who I think is an excellent researcher. And I'll post some links to the episodes I researched here in the episode itself. But, you know, he covers Iran-Contra and opium dealing and the CIA's connection. I feel like if you're reading this stuff correctly, like you kind of need to have a left analysis to put it all together, because it's all pretty explicit that like there's a through line, and he uses a term called the Fourth Reich. The Third Reich ends, the Fourth Reich begins anew. You know, fascism never dies. I'm just saying all that to say I feel pretty strongly about, like, you know, I've done my research. I am, you know, strongly against the CIA and the intelligence state's evils it's committed, but I can look at that through a leftist or worker-based or people's lens, you know, and I that's what I think this book does well. I'm trying to get this conversation going.
Yeah, I mean, for me especially, it is very clear that the events they chose to cover, insofar as, you know, Southeast Asia, you know, all the stuff with Pinochet and Noriega, like they're all done to sort of push this leftist lens of, you know, like this is clearly the MO of the CIA. And again, like we've seen that sort of push in other things. Like when we were doing our Black Sun episode, the CIA's involvement in Japan's post-war growth, you know, like it's clear that it can be done with a leftist bent, I guess, is the word that's coming to mind. But there has to be that sort of explicit acknowledgement, which I think this story does, like, super, super well.
I would agree.
Like, even if you somehow didn't know that Moore and I guess Sienkiewicz were not leftists prior to reading this. You know, like within a few pages, you could easily tell. You know, like portraying America as an anthropomorphic evil, a drunk. You know, like come on. It's the iconography, I think, especially, and this is what Sienkiewicz really, really excels at, putting that iconography into play, to sort of push not just the rhetoric, but like the messaging of what exactly they're trying to do. Because like we joked at the beginning, that is sort of like a recap comic, but in a sense, it's not just a recap comic. It is sort of, you know, like pushing ideas forward.
This is Moore's prose at some of its finest. Mm. I mean, you know, there's plenty of criticisms that are people lobby at Moore, and I wouldn't call myself a Moore fanboy by any means, but like, you know, I have respect for how he does his art. I think he always commits. And I, you know, while reading this, I thought like, why not just do this as a prose piece? And then, you know, the more you read it, like you're saying, like this anthropomorphic eagle, like it's so suited to the comics medium. If I can read a panel here that I think is really beautiful, he's talking about, you know, this like sort of coke business, you know, moving the CIA, moving coke around.
Well, what page is this?
The eagle is like, this is 24, at least in the British edition that I have.
One thing I want to say about this is like a complete side note, but the way they do the page numbers is really funny. Like the format, there's no consistent format to it. It's just like one time it'll be written as a number, one time it'll be written in like text, and sometimes it'll be like a mix of the two. Sometimes it'll use like Roman numerals. Like the slapdash sort of haphazard nature of the entire craft of the book is very, very, like, it's not even like the genuine thing. It's just like very interesting. It's just like a very, visually interesting book to read.
It's fascinating too, because this like was not the era of like, oh, like post a single panel for clout, like, and yet there's some really great single panels. Like, you know, when he spells the word assassinate anywhere in the lettering, the SS is always like the German SS, to like make clear the CIA's ways and methods. But this panel I wanted to talk about is says biggest operation in decades, the coke operation. Nobody could figure out how we supplied our Contras. Let me tell you a secret. It's all done with mirrors. It's amazing. I mean, it's like why people need to read this book, but this eagle is so high off of his gourd that like his head is like imploding into like a cosmic big bang. Like, it's like all lights.
Yeah, like the two panels before, you know, like actually just the whole page. It really starts with this sort of like very solid drawing of a very realistic anthropomorphic eagle, and it sort of jukes between, you know, a more impressionistic style for the first, I'd say, six panels of this 9-panel grid. But then you get to panel 7, and then that's where Sienkiewicz really starts to cook. You know, like when you see that first glint, that real glint of the coke off the mirror, and then the effects of that in the next panel, where he's no longer a bird, he's literally just a mess. And then the next panel over, he just explodes visually. I think it's such a good conveyance of just the mirrors and coke aspect of it. Sienkiewicz was cooking here in a way that I rarely have ever seen him cook in other books.
Yeah, it's like the last time you've seen him cook like this, it's a more mainstream thing I can think of, but it'd be like his Daredevil stuff.
Yeah, like Love and War. Miller,
you know? But just, I think this panel works so well because, like, there's this idea of, like, coke and mirrors. But, you know, there's also this idea of, like, mirrors in a theatrical sense, and, like, how the CIA can use mirrors to deflect criticism or to just hide its operations entirely, right? And he's drawing this sort of lens flare that's both blinding and yet leads out in infinite directions, like, you know, rays that will never meet. Like, I think it really, like, conveys visually the sort of insurmountable nature of the CIA. Like, it's something so big,
the vastness,
that, like,
until you, you know, like,
yes, thank you,
the reach, because, you know, like, no matter how much you can try to attack them, the reach you will never be able to replicate.
Yeah, this book is fucking good. I wasn't ready for it.
It's weird because, you know, the prose of it is more, but in a way it's also not more. Like, in terms of the synthesis between the art and the writing itself, I think this was, like, I want to know what the collaboration between Moore and Sienkiewicz here was. Because, you know, like, I've seen Moore's scripts, you know, like, I've heard artists, like, I heard Chuck Austin talk about what it was like working with Moore's scripts. But, like, this feels much more like Moore and Sienkiewicz were cooking together, you know, like, side by side.
It's not dominated.
Yeah. This is like a real synthesis. And the mixed media aspect too, it's especially really
for the subject matter.
Like, everything works in conjunction with each other, and nothing really sticks out. Like, yeah, there's a lot of text, but the text is, again, it doesn't stick out to you in the way that, say, a panel of Watchmen would.
Yeah, and I think too that also answers, like, why this needed to be a comic, because, you know, we're trying not to recap the recap, but, you know, we got to answer these questions, right? And it's like, you know, I look at parapolitics and the history of the CIA, like, almost every day. I'm doing some level of research for it because my brain is broken, I suppose. But, you know, even really good researchers or research that you want to look at, it's hard for it to not just be like this endless list of names and dates and events, even when it's good research. So when you incorporate this visual element, it breaks up the text, and it's something that's more emotionally resonant. And that's really key for getting this information to the people.
Like, and that's what I'm wondering is, like, the Christic Institute obviously chose to use comics as a medium to convey their message. And I wonder how much reach, because, you know, like you said, Eclipse was rivaling Marvel and DC at the time. Getting a book like this out there is huge for the Christic Institute. Yet in the years since, it's kind of just gone by the wayside and been lost to time, in a sense. And I feel like that's also, like, not a metaphor per se, but I think it is an interesting reflection on the Christic Institute's entire being. The Christic Institute, we have, I think, been referring to them in the past tense because they no longer exist. I mentioned earlier that they do have a replacement in the form of the Romero Institute. Yeah, I guess we can talk a bit about the aftermath.
Yeah, I want to go into the aftermath and how that ties into Hull, but I want to touch briefly on Romero. Do you know who the Romero is that they're referring to?
You know, I looked into this and I did not read that specific element, no.
So I think this is, like, just really key for, like, understanding the sort of shape of the world this book is painting, and for, like, understanding the Christic Institute themselves, because, like, I'm not necessarily trying to be their cheerleader. I can't speak to their entire history, but, you know, like, I think it's undeniable they did some good research and had some good cases and good intentions along the way. But the Romero Institute, like Lan had mentioned before, it's, you know, made of the pieces of the Christic Institute. A lot of the Christic Institute founders go on to create Romero Institute. Romero Institute is named after an Archbishop Oscar Romero.
Okay.
Oscar Romero was the Archbishop of San Salvador and El Salvador. Big deal, you know, in a sense. Yeah. And he was assassinated by Contras, essentially. This businessman, De Buisson, he's a plantation owner in El Salvador, I believe. He hires guys who either were Contras or went on to become Contras to assassinate Romero in the middle of a sermon. Jeez. And Romero was assassinated because he was trying to bring, trying to play up peace in El Salvador at the time, because it was controlled by, and you guessed it, United States backed right wing government. And there were left wing freedom fighters trying to take it down. And he was trying to preach peace. So he was assassinated by these Contras. And I think it's really key to identify that the guy who hired them, this plantation owner, De Buisson, went on to become one of the initial angel investors of a little company called Bain Capital.
Oh.
Mitt Romney's firm.
What are you doing there, Mitt? What's going on here? Yeah.
Now, hey, I might have fudged a name or two there. I cribbed a lot of that from Michael S. Judge's research, but I think it's all really important to understand. Like, that's the general shape of that. And
Salt here. I did indeed conflate some names, namely De Buisson with the Salaverria brothers. The Salaverria brothers contributed largely to the success of De Buisson. And the Salaverria brothers were also the contributors, major backers to Mitt Romney's Bain Capital. There you go.
So anyways, I wanted to get that out of the way. Do you want to go into the demise of the Christic Institute?
Yeah, so I think to talk about the demise of the Christic Institute, we got to talk about Avergan versus Hull. And I think Avergan versus Hull is very interesting because it is literally at the forefront of this comic. You literally have them thanking Martha Honey and Tony Avergan in the beginning of this book. So what Avergan versus Hull is, this was the Lapensa.
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm gonna say Lapensa. Anyways, the Lapensa bombing happened in 1984 in Nicaragua, on the border of Nicaragua and Costa Rica. And in that bombing, two journalists named Tony Avergan and Martha Honey wanted to sue, obviously, because they thought that the bombing was part of a conspiracy that the CIA was behind. And so it blew the lid open on sort of the connection between the CIA and all these assassination attempts, as well as arms and drug trafficking. People that were named in this suit were huge Iran Contra figures, such as John Singlob, Albert Hakim, Thomas Climes, Theodore Shackley, and of course, John Hull. So this was a huge case, which I believe started in 1988, so like the same year that this came out. And this actually forms the basis for the second story in this book. Flashpoint, is that what it's called?
I think so.
Right. Okay, I need to verify because otherwise I'm going to lose my mind. Fliss, it's Flashpoint, LA Pensa bombing.
So a lot less murder of superheroes' parents than...
Yeah, yeah, and I should say, this is a book that purports to have two stories, but like the majority of it is shadow play
more in Sienkiewicz's book,
with the LA Pensa stuff taking up like 2 to 4 pages. Because again, it was so fresh at the time, and obviously there's not a lot that you can say without running into legal troubles themselves, because it was an ongoing case at the time. But the long and short of it is the case did not go well for them. Surprise, surprise, it didn't go well with them. So in 1989, the Christic Institute was forced to pay $955,000 in attorney fees and $79,000 in court costs. From there, the IRS stripped them of their nonprofit designation. peters from there, you know, like it didn't fully dissolve until 1991. By the time that the case had ended, the IRS was claiming that the case was done for frivolous. Yes, it was frivolous, and it was done for political reasons. And as a result, that's why they had stripped them of their nonprofit designation. And, you know, like from there onwards, it petered off into nothingness, which was then, you know, obviously replaced by the Romero Institute, which continues to exist to this day.
Yeah, I think they're doing like a lot more environmental issues now. Yeah.
But it's funny because the Romero Institute is the one that has the Unmask the Shadow government poster on their Wikipedia page, even though it's a Christic Institute thing.
Yeah, because they're largely the same entity. And like, I guess the sort of big question to me with the Christic Institute, well, there's two questions in a way. Like, the one I asked already is like, what are these supposed right wing causes they devolved into? And maybe those exist. Like, I really don't know. I couldn't find any, but that's a typical smearing you get upon someone when they're like, you know, trying to take down big shadowy government entities. And the other big question is, you know, when they botched that case, did they botch it because they were wrong and, you know, there was no CIA involvement in this bombing? Or, you know, did they botch the case because they were not prepared enough and, you know, the CIA kind of ran one over on them?
Yeah, do you know what I'm saying? I mean, I feel like I lean more towards the latter. It definitely does feel like they were sort of going into this with this sort of candor of knowing what they knew based off of like public reports and whatnot. But at the end of the day, documentation wise, this is what I mean. The vastness of this CIA just ended up working against their favor. You're going up against one of the biggest institutions in the entire world. It's very difficult to do that without the most concrete, infallible proof that there is. And also, you know, the system just fucking works against them, you know, like there is that part.
I mean, yeah, I was gonna say that too. Like, even with like concrete evidence, you can make a bullet, you know, pirouette and like do whatever you want in space. You know, talking about the demise of the Christic Institute is a good time to talk about the demise of Eclipse as well.
Yeah, yeah. Around the same time too, actually.
I mean, this is... Yeah, around the same time. This is a lot shorter and not as complex. Seems to be the main factors were a flood and a divorce.
Yeah, you know, as these things, as it happens.
I mean, if they had had all those comics as NFTs, I don't think this flood would have.
Yeah, maybe if they had Iran-Contra NFTs instead of trading cards. Yeah, you know, me personally, I would have done it differently.
Yeah, I mean, Eclipse had kind of bounced around the country for a while, and they had settled in Guerneville, not far from where I grew up, and a really bad flood knocked out, like, $500,000 or something of backstock.
Oh, shit.
So I think that was a really bad financial hit for them, and then the other problem was that Ironwood divorced, I think his name was Delaney,
Mulaney.
The other guy in Mulaney, thank you.
She divorces Mulaney, you know.
I think on the bright side, you know, Ironwood got to live in tantric partnership with her partner on whatever magic commune they're on now. So
good for her. You know what? Good for her.
Exactly. She made out all right.
But the other thing to note is that the company's IP was bought out by... The Todd McFarlane. For viewers at home, I'm going to give you 10 seconds to guess how much he bought all of Eclipse's IP for. 10, 9, 8, 7.
Spoiler alert, it was $25,000. Yep.
$25,000.
It all comes back to Todd.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I'm just wondering what possessed him to even buy it in the first place.
I'm Todd McFarlane, creator of Spawn. Trading cards, baby.
I'm sure he wanted the Iran-Contra trading cards. Yeah, that's exactly why. Because, you know, the Todd shirtless playing, what is it, baseball on the trading cards. That was so yesteryear. You know, the kids these days, they want a 1993 World Trade Center bombing attempt trading cards. That's what they're trying to get.
I do want that. And I'm looking up the shirtless Todd McFarlane baseball card. It's, that is glorious. It's good. So I think we covered the most important players and, you know, how Lan and I could have sort of best figured they might have converged and produced this. I mean, when all's said and done, it's... I just find it remarkable that this happened at all.
Yeah, absolutely.
This work, I mean. And, you know, that leads me to the question I've kept coming back to, like, is there room for this to happen in comics?
Hold on, are you positing, perhaps, I should say, are you positing that you couldn't make this comic today? Are you saying that this is the...
Not with cancel culture and all that.
Yeah, not with... You couldn't make... This is the comics equivalent of Blazing Saddles.
I mean, I think you could make this. What I guess I'm saying is, like, I don't see anyone who is at the level of superstardom of Moore and Sienkiewicz. Like, that was peak Moore, peak Sienkiewicz.
Yep.
I don't see anyone near that level of equivalent superstardom even wanting to make a book like this. Like, and even if there was, I don't see a publisher wanting to do it.
Okay, so first posit, who exactly... Actually, you know what? You know what would be... I literally just came to my mind right now. You know, be a great follow-up this episode. Covering James Tynan's Department of Truth comic. Have you heard of that?
I don't know what that... I barely even know who this James person is. So Tynan, I'm happy to do a future episode on
James Tynan. His name is spelled T-Y-N-I-O-N. One of the biggest proponents of Substack during its... Do you know him?
I read two comics a year, Lan. I read two comics a year. I don't know what this is.
Truly one of comics publishing's greatest Twitter posters. He literally only comes online on Twitter to complain about Twitter and then advertise, not just complain about how unethical and how horrible a platform it is before advertising his newsletter on Substack.com.
That's great.
Beautiful, beautiful mind. And I love every time he does it. I always love listening about his posts because it's just a beautiful mind. You really just gotta appreciate this kind of mentality. You know, like you really don't see with all these like, these idiots trying to be what, outlaws of comics? No, we need more Substack writers who are forming parasocial relationships with their readers. You know, we need more writers who are willing to treat their fans as the dopes they are. So anyways, James Tynan the fourth, I should say, the James Tynan the fourth wrote a comic called The Department of Truth. I think it started coming out in 2020, and it is pretty much about like conspiracy theory shit. So like the JFK assassination, flat Earth theory, like Lizard Man and whatnot. I think it got like four volumes.
Yeah, this guy sounds like a clown. I'm sorry. Oh, like, I don't think this guy is on
be,
like
you don't need to level. Be sorry, but I'm saying. Like having finally actually read Brought to Light now, I want to go back and actually read Department of Truth because it definitely feels like Department.
Oh, kind of a sequel.
Like a sequel episode. We'll do like 6 months down the line.
Great.
Because Department of Truth feels like Tynan wanting to do his own Brought to Light.
I see.
So I want to see how that actually stacks up.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth covering just because, you know, it does answer my question. Like, who is doing this right now? And it's like, there's, you know, I think it was probably a long shot in the 80s, too, right? And so you look at it now, it's even more of a long shot, right? With how much the world has changed.
And I feel like how much more conservative, even the more left-leaning writers in the comics industry have gotten. Like, ever since the 90s, it's pretty much been fuck you, pay me. You know, like the collectivist effort is pretty much gone in the big leagues of comics these days.
Right. And like you said, like even a lefty like Bill Sienkiewicz seems a lot more toned down than he was, you know, at that time.
You know, maybe you're right. Maybe this comic couldn't be made today, or maybe we're both wrong. And, you know, the Department of Truth is actually a masterpiece in the same vein as Brought to Light, and it blew the doors open on Noriega again.
Before we close out, I guess there's just one more topic I want to cover in Brought to Light, and it's observations of the world and magic. Yes.
A lot of magicians involved in this
book. Right? Because you've got Moore is a magician. You've got Ironwood is a magician. You know, you can't overstate it, too, that a lot of the sort of ghouls involved in the world of intelligence and the far right are magicians themselves, in a way.
Because they make people disappear.
Hey,
I see it.
the presence of magic in the world, it's like, the way I see it is, it doesn't matter whether you as an individual believe that magic is real. If someone more powerful than you believes in magic and operates magically, well, then your world and the way it carries itself, the way the world turns, will happen in a magical lens.
Yeah.
Or will operate by magical rules, I should say.
I think the tough thing about the magic of this is also just how much it can play into conspiracy theories as well. Like the whole, you know, occult sure. aspect of this. And it's a thin line to tread, I guess, to sort of balance on.
I'm not trying to say to the viewers, like, now is the time you need to start practicing chaos magic and drawing sigils and jerking yourself off until you buy all the invisibles. That's not at all what I'm saying. I guess what I more mean is, like, I think it's kind of perfect that a declared magician like Moore would handle this, because he's got this, you know, magical practice he does, but he's also got, he's coupled his magical practice with real research into these concrete events. And I think that's how you wind up with the really great imagery in the book of this, you know, eagle, like, tearing off its own talon and then regenerating said talon. Like, you know, that's what separates this from just being like a list of dates. You know, I see that creativity and understanding the importance of, like, ritual and sacrifice and how that plays into a magical worldview. That works really well for trying to conjure the sort of imagery of this comic. And I guess the last thing I'll say about magic, too, is, like, you know, it, again, like, it doesn't matter whether you as a person believe in it. Like, I would say I probably don't believe in magic in a meaningful way. But,
I think I'm magic agnostic.
Magic agnostic. Yeah. But when I say magic, I'm also talking about religion. I'm talking about those on a continuum. Like, when you look at, you know, the ancient Norse or the Aztecs, you know, a lot of ancient cultures very openly practiced human sacrifice. Right. And that does not go away, you know, despite, you know, the creation of the world liberal order. I'm not trying to say new world order. I'm trying to say the liberal order that, you know, where we have liberal governments, liberal markets that decide how a lot of development happens. Just because you have that doesn't mean that human sacrifice disappears. And there's definitely going to be people at the top, whether they're politicians or, you know, in business or intelligence assets like this. These are people who believe in human sacrifice in some way, even if their idea of human sacrifice is less, oh, I need to sacrifice a slave to Odin for good luck. It's less that and more, oh, we can sacrifice the peoples of Nicaragua to you know, create greater market shares. Like, that's what I mean by magic.
I see. Okay. Yeah.
And I think Moore is the kind of person who can understand that and synthesize that all into a comic that sounds a little more coherent than me.
I think that's pretty much all I have to say about this book for now. Other than Moore is still alive as of this recording, and he's still practicing magic, and I really want to read his new book, Illuminations. Again, Bill's doing fine. He's taken up his new career as a portrait artist, very seriously.
Thanks for doing this with me, man. This was like a really hard book to tackle in a lot of ways.
I'm glad that you took the lead on most of this, and I was actually like scared every time I talked, because to me it up until now we've covered, you know, like Toku stuff, and then the one comic thing we did in between that, other than, you know, the Toku related stuff, was, you know, the interview with Seth. So doing this is like, I feel like this is the first big leagues for the podcast, you know, like.
There, we have, I'll have this in the show notes. We have a way for you to contact us now, because.
Okay, I'm holding
on. Yes! That's what we almost forgot. We have an email address.
Oh my God, I forgot.
Yeah, so if you have questions or comments for the show, you want us to cover something, or if you just have a question you want us to answer, or if you want to say, you rock, or you want to say, you suck, anything like that, email us at midnightgrapplerAnimals@gmail.com. Email us. We'd love to hear from you.
Follow us on Twitter, and because you can follow me on at LanTweets, LanTweets, and you can follow Salt on Twitter at SaltMBank, which is SaltMBank. I need to spell that out because it's an audio format. Yeah.
Hey, so you know the email, you know our ads. Thank you for listening.
Yeah, let's get out of here. See ya.
Well, it's a good business. The government brings in the drugs, and the government distributes the drugs, takes those profits, and then hires our taxpayers' money, lots of police, and builds jails, and arrests the people who are caught with the drugs, little people, and puts them in jail, and gets the money from the prisons, and the forced labor from the prisoners, where that exists, and more money for police, for more drug busts, and plus the fact that they get at least half of the profit from the drugs that they bring in themselves. It's quite a good business.